awful front riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
This is Dan Kimmler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will continue to read from Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories. This was edited by Craig Leslie and Catherine Stavrakis. The book was published in 1991 by Delta Trade Paperbacks Press in New York City. I remind you that our stories may be edited slightly for recording. We will start with Thomas King's A Seat in the Garden. Joe Hovaugh settled into the garden on his knees and began pulling at the wet, slippery weeds that had sprung up between the neat rows of beets. He troweled his way around a zucchini and up and down the lines of carrots, and he did not notice the big Indian at all until he stopped at the tomatoes, sat back, and tried to remember where he had set the ball of twine and the wooden stakes. The big Indian was naked to the waist. His hair was braided and wrapped with white ermine and strips of red cloth. He wore a single feather held in place by a leather band stretched around his head, and, even though his arms were folded tightly across his chest, Joe could see the glitter and flash of silver and turquoise on each finger.
"If you build it, they will come," said the big Indian.
Joe rolled forward and shielded his eyes from the morning sun.
"If you build it, they will come," said the big Indian again.
"Christ sakes," Joe shouted. "Get the hell out of the corn, will you?"
"If you build it?"
Yeah. Hey, this is private property. You people ever hear of private property?"
"They will come."
Joe struggled to his feet and got his shovel from the shed. But when he got back to the garden, the big Indian was gone.
"All right," Joe shouted, and drove the nose of the shovel into the ground. "Come out of that corn."
The corn stalks were only about a foot tall. Nonetheless, Joe walked each row, the shovel held at the ready, just in case the big Indian tried to take him by surprise. When Red Matthews came by in the afternoon, Joe poured him a cup of coffee and told him about the big Indian and what he had said. Red told Joe that he had seen the movie.
"Wasn't a movie, Red. Damn it. He was a real Indian. He was just standing there in the corn.
You probably scared him away.
You can't let them go standing in your garden whenever they feel like it."
That's the truth.
The next day, when Joe came out to the garden to finish staking the tomatoes, the big Indian was waiting for him. The man looked as though he were asleep, but as soon as he saw Joe, he straightened up and crossed his arms on his chest.
"You again.
If you build it,
I'm going to call the police. You hear me? The police are going to come and haul you away."
"They will come."
Joe turned around and marched back into the house and phoned the RCMP, who said they would send someone over that very afternoon.
"Afternoon? What am I supposed to do with him until then? Feed him lunch?"
The RCMP officer told Joe that it might be best if he stayed in the house. There was the chance, the officer said, that the big Indian might be drunk or on drugs, and if that were the case, it was better if Joe didn't antagonize him.
"He's walking on my corn. Does that mean anything to you?"
The RCMP officer assured Joe that it meant a great deal to him, that his wife was a gardener, and he knew how she would feel if someone walked on her corn.
"Still," said the officer, "it's best if you don't do anything."
What Joe did was to call Red. And when Red arrived, the big Indian was still in the garden, waiting.
"Wow, he's a big sucker, all right," said Red. "You know, he looks a little like Jeff Chandler.
I called the police, and they said not to antagonize him. Hey, there are two of us, right?
That's right, said Joe.
You bet it's right.
Joe got the shovel and a hoe from the shed, and he and Red wandered out into the garden as if nothing were wrong.
He's watching us, said Red.
Don't step on the tomatoes, said Joe.
Joe walked around the zucchini, casually dragging the shovel behind him.
Red ambled through the beets, the hoe slung over his shoulder.
If you build it, they will come, the Indian said. Get him, shouted Joe,
and before Red could do anything, Joe was charging through the carrots, the shovel held out in front of him like a lance.
Wait a minute, Joe,
yelled Red, the hoe still on his shoulder. But Joe was already into the tomatoes. He was closing on the big Indian, who hadn't moved, when he stepped on the bundle of wooden stakes and went down in a heap.
Hey, said Red, you okay?
Red helped Joe to his feet, and when the two men looked around, the big Indian was gone.
Where'd he go? Said Joe. Beats me, said Red. What'd you do to get him so angry?
Red helped Joe to the house, wrapped an ice pack on his ankle, and told him to put his leg on the chair.
I saw a movie a couple years back about a housing development that was built on top of an ancient Indian burial ground, Red said. I would have got him if I hadn't tripped. They finally had to get an authentic medicine man to come in and appease the spirits.
Did you see the look on his face when he saw me coming?
And you should have seen some of those spirits.
When the RCMP arrived, Joe showed the officer where the Indian had stood, how he had run at him with the shovel, and how he had stumbled over the bundle of stakes. After Joe got up and brushed himself off, the RCMP officer asked him if he recognized the big Indian.
Not likely, said Joe. There aren't any Indians around here. Yeah, there are, said Red. Remember those three guys who come around on weekends ever so often?
The old winos? Said Joe.
They have that grocery cart and they pick up cans.
They don't count.
They sit down there by the hydrangea and crush the cans and eat their lunch. Sometimes they get to singing.
You mean drink their lunch?
Well, they could have anything in that bottle.
Most likely Lysol. The RCMP officer walked through the garden with Joe and Red and made a great many notes. He shook hands with both of the men and told Joe to call him if there was any more trouble.
Did you ever wonder, said Red, after the officer left, just what he wants you to build or who they are?
I suppose you saw a movie.
Maybe we should ask the Indians.
The drunks?
Maybe they could translate for us.
The guy speaks English.
That's right, Joe. God, this gets stranger all the time. Ed Ames, that's who he reminds me of.
On Saturday morning, when Joe and Red walked out on the porch, the big Indian was waiting patiently for them in the corn. They were too far away to hear him, but they could see his mouth moving.
Okay, said Red. All we gotta do is wait for the Indians to show up.
They showed up around noon. One Indian had a green knapsack. The other two pushed a grocery cart in front of them. It was full of cans and bottles. They were old, Joe noticed, and even from the porch, he imagined he could smell them. They walked to a corner of the garden behind the hydrangea where the sprinklers didn't reach. It was a dry, scraggly wedge that Joe had never bothered to cultivate. As soon as the men stopped the cart and sat down on the ground, Red got to his feet and stretched.
Come on, can't hurt to talk with them. Grab a couple of beers so they know we're friendly. A good whack with a shovel would be easier. Hey, this is kind of exciting. Don't you think this is kind of exciting? I wouldn't trip this time.
When Joe and Red got to the corner, the three men were busy crushing the cans. One man would put a can on a flat stone, and the second man would step on it.
The third man picked up the crushed can and put it in a brown grocery bag. They were older than Joe had thought, and they didn't smell as bad as he had expected.
"Hi," said Red. "That there's a nice collection of cans."
"Good morning," said the first Indian.
"Getting pretty hot," said the second Indian.
"You fellas like a drink?" said the third Indian, and he took a large glass bottle out of the knapsack.
"No, thanks," said Red. "You fellas like a beer?"
"Lemon water," said the third Indian. "My wife makes it without any sugar, so it's not as sweet as most people like it."
"How can you guys drink that stuff?" said Joe.
"You get used to it," said the second Indian, "and it's better for you than pop."
As the first Indian twisted the lid off the bottle and took a long drink, Joe looked around to make sure none of his neighbors were watching him.
"I'll bet you guys know just about everything there is to know about Indians," said Red.
"Well," said the first Indian, "Jimmy and Frank are Nootka, and I'm Cree. You guys reporters or something?"
"Reporters? No."
"You never know," said the second Indian. "Last month, a couple of reporters did a story on us. Took pictures and everything."
"It's good that these kind of problems are brought to the public's attention," said Red.
"You bet," said the third Indian. "Everyone's got to help. Otherwise, there's going to be more garbage than people."
Joe was already bored with the conversation. He looked back to see if the big Indian was still there. "This is all nice and friendly," said Joe. "But we've got a problem that we were hoping you might be able to help us with."
"Sure," said the first Indian. "What's the problem?"
Joe snapped the tab on one of the beers, took a long swig, and jerked his thumb in the direction of the garden. "I've got this big Indian who likes to stand in my garden."
"Where?"
asked the second Indian.
"Right there," said Joe.
"Right where?" asked the third Indian.
"If you build it, they will come," shouted the big Indian.
"There, there," said Joe. "Did you hear that?"
"Hear what?" said the first Indian.
"They're embarrassed," said Red under his breath. "Let me handle this."
"This is beginning to piss me off," said Joe, and he took another pull on the beer.
"We were just wondering," Red began, "if you woke up one day and found a big Indian standing in your cornfield, and all he would say was, 'If you build it, they will come,' what would you do?"
"I'd stop drinking," said the second Indian, and the other two Indians covered their faces with their hands.
"No, no," said Red, "that's not what I mean." "Well, you see that big Indian over there in the cornfield, don't you?"
The Indians looked at each other, and then they looked at Joe and Red.
"Okay," said the first Indian.
"Sure, I see him."
"Oh, yeah," said the second Indian. "He's right there. All right.
In the beets?"
"Corn," said Joe.
"Right," said the third Indian.
"In the corn. I can see him, too. Clear as day."
"That's our problem," said Red. "We think maybe he's a spirit or something."
"No, we don't," said Joe.
"Yes, we do," said Red, who was just getting going. "We figure he wants us to build something to appease him so he'll go away."
"Sort of like a spirit?" said the first Indian.
"Hey," said the second Indian, "remember that movie we saw about that community that was built?"
"That's the one," said Red.
"What we have to figure out is what he wants us to build. You guys got any idea?"
The three Indians looked at each other. The first Indian looked at the cornfield. Then he looked at Joe and Red.
"Tell you what," he said. "We'll go over there and talk to him, see what he wants. He looks Cree. You guys stay here, okay?"
Joe and Red watched as the three Indians walked into the garden. They stood together, facing the beets.
"Hey," shouted Joe. "You guys blind? He's behind you."
The first Indian waved his hand and smiled,
and the three men turned around. Red could see them talking, and he tried to watch their lips, but he couldn't figure out what they were saying. After a while, the Indians waved at the rows of carrots and came back over to where Joe and Red were waiting.
"Well," said Red, "did you talk to him?"
"Yes," said the first Indian. "You were right. He is a spirit."
"I knew it," shouted Red. "What does he want?"
The first Indian looked back to the cornfield. "He's tired of standing," he says. "He wants a place to sit down, but he doesn't want to mess up the garden. He says he'd like it if you would build him a bench right about here."
"A bench?" said Joe.
"That's what he said."
"So he can sit down?"
"He gets tired of standing."
"The hell you say."
"Do you still see him?" asked the second Indian.
"You blind? Of course I still see him."
"Then I'd get started on the bench right away," said the third Indian.
"Come on, Red," said Joe,
and he threw the empty beer can into the hydrangea and opened the other one. "We got to talk." Joe put the pad of paper on the kitchen table and drew a square. "This is the garden," he said. "These are the carrots. These are the beets. These are the beans. And this is the corn. The big Indian is right about here."
"That's right," said Red. "But what does that mean?"
"Here's where those winos crush their cans and drink their Lysol," Joe continued, making a spot on the pad and drawing a line to it.
"Lemon water."
"Are you listening?"
"Sure."
"If you draw lines from the house to where the big Indian stands, and from there to where the winos crush their cans, and back to the house. Now, do you see it?"
"Hey, that's pretty good, Joe."
"What does it remind you of?"
"A bench."
"No," said Joe, "a triangle."
"Oh, okay, I can see that."
"And if you look at it like this, you can see clearly that the winos and the big Indian are there, and the house where you and I are is here."
"What if you looked at it this way, Joe?"
said Red, and he turned the paper a half turn to the right.
"Now the house is there, and the old guys and the big Indian are here."
"That's not the way you look at it. That's not the way it works."
"Does that mean we're not going to build the bench?"
"It's our battle plan."
"A bench might be simpler," said Red.
"I'll attack him from the house along this line. You take him from the street along that line. We'll catch him between us."
"I don't know that this is going to work."
"Just don't step on the tomatoes." The next morning, Red waited behind the hydrangea. He was carrying the hoe and a camera. Joe crouched by the corner of the house with the shovel.
"Charge!"
yelled Joe, and he broke from his hiding place and lumbered across the lawn and into the garden. Red leapt through the hydrangea and struggled up the slight incline to the cornfield.
"If you build it, they'll come," shouted the Indian.
"Build it yourself,"
shouted Joe, and he swung the shovel at the big Indian's legs. Red, who was slower, stopped at the edge of the cornfield to watch Joe whack the Indian with his shovel and to take a picture. So he saw Joe and his shovel run right through the Indian and crash into the compost mound.
Joe, you all right? God, you should have seen it. You ran right through that guy, just like he weren't there. I got a great picture. Wait till you see the picture. Just around the eyes. He looks a little bit like Sal Mineo."
Red helped Joe back to the house and cleaned the cuts on Joe's face. He wrapped another ice pack on Joe's ankle and then drove down to the one-hour photo store and turned the film in. By the time he got back to the house, Joe was standing on the porch, leaning on the railing.
"You won't believe it, Joe," said Red. "Look at this."
Red fished a photograph out of the pack. It showed Joe and the shovel in mid-swing, plunging through the corn. The colors were brilliant. Joe looked at the photograph for a minute, and then he looked at the cornfield. Where's the big Indian?
That's just it. He's not there.
Christ!
Does that mean we're going to build the bench?
The bench was a handsome affair with a concrete base and a wooden seat. The Indians came by the very next Saturday with their knapsack and grocery cart, and Red could tell that they were impressed.
Boy, said the first Indian, that's a good-looking bench. You think this'll take care of the problem? Asked Red.
That Indian still in the cornfield? Said the second Indian.
Of course he's still there, said Joe. Can't you hear him?
I don't know, said the third Indian, and he twisted the lid off the bottle and took a drink. I don't think he's one of ours.
What should we do?
Well, don't throw your cans in the hydrangea, said the first Indian. It's hard to get them out. We're not as young as we used to be. Joe and Red spent the rest of the day sitting on the porch, drinking beer, and watching the big Indian in the garden. He looked a little like Victor Mature, Red thought, now that he had time to think about it. Or maybe Anthony Quinn, only he was taller. And there was an air about the man that made Red believe with all his heart, that he had met this Indian before. And that was Thomas King's A Seat in the Garden. Now we will read Killing the Bear by Judith Minty. She strung the hammock between two birch trees at the edge of the clearing. Now she drifts in and out of the light there and drowsily studies the pattern made by the rope's weaving and the flickering of the leaves. When she had the dog, he stretched out beneath the hammock, hackles raised, growling and nipping at flies, he'd meant to save her from shadows. In truth, he startled at noises, even at shifts in the wind, and she'd ended up more his protector than the other way around. There were wolves at the little zoo when she was a child. She heard them howling from her aunt's kitchen and went to see them up close. And there was a bear. 3 times she visited, slowly circling the bear pen, but he was always sleeping. He looked like a bundle of clothes by the dead tree. His fence was electrified and posted with signs, and she was afraid to touch the iron bars. The wolves set off a chorus of neighborhood dogs. Their calling floated back and forth all that summer vacation. She lies in the hammock every afternoon, her life in the rhythm of the woods. Up at dawn, to the shrill pitch of blue jays, logs tossed into the stove, match lit, breath steaming in the cabin's chill. Trip to the outhouse, coffee perking, bucket of water from the river. The rest of the morning, ping of nails driven into boards. Her porch is nearly done. 1 room and another room. Something inside and something out. The afternoon silence and the sway of the hammock lull her, and when she hears a low guttural, she thinks at first it's the dog. Then she remembers that the dog is gone. She struggles to sit up and makes the hammock sway crazily. A bear stands beyond the pines. Small jets of eyes, heavy black coat. He snuffles, then drops on all fours and weaves into the forest. Her hands lift to cover her breast. Her favorite doll was a stuffed animal, and she slept with it close to her heart. She was 9 when her mother said, "Give me your bear for 3 months. Let's see if you can stop sucking your thumb." She tried very hard to stop, and when the time was up, she asked for the bear again. Her mother said, "Another month." One day, as she sat in the kitchen watching a cake being stirred and poured into the pan and then put into the oven, it came to her that her bear was gone, that it had been thrown down the incinerator.
only a few years ago, her mother told her, misspeaking even then, "I'm sorry for burning the animal in you." Her hammer has stopped its thump and echo. The roof is laid. The porch smells of fresh paint. She's hauled the old sofa out and can sit there in the evenings if she wants. When the bear understood that she was alone, he came closer. The first time, she was reading in the hammock and heard something like a sigh. She knew it was him even before she caught a glimpse of black gliding through the woods. The next time, he was so close that she smelled him, a terrible, rancid odor. Without looking, she swung out of the hammock and walked to the cabin. 2 days later, he stood next to the birch tree, breath rattling his throat. If she had turned, she could have touched the bristles on his shoulder. The Gilyak tribe honored him. They put his head on a stake outside their doors and made offerings to it. On Yezo Island, the hyenas thought he was a man trapped inside the body of a bear. If a hunter found a cub, he brought it to his wife who suckled it. In Lapland, he was king of beasts. The men lived alone, purifying themselves for 3 days after the hunt. At the funeral, after they had feasted, they put his bones back together in the ground. Once she spent an evening with two Swedes. At dinner, their wine glasses held the tint of leaves. Ole, the painter, said, "You live in green light." Gunnar told magic tales. When a woman meets a bear in the woods, she must lift her skirt. Then he will let her pass. In the travelogue about Alaska, the Kodiak caught a salmon, his claws stretched out like fingers. When the second bear approached, he reared up. He looked soft and gentle, as if he were greeting a friend. Until, with a swipe of his paw, he split open the head of the other. In college, a classmate told about the summer he'd worked at Yellowstone and had gotten too close. He never felt the nick, only knew when blood trickled down his forehead. There was also the news story about the woman dragged from her tent in the middle of the night crying, "He's killing me! Oh God, he's killing me!" The bear carried the woman away, his claws tangled in her hair, ripping at her arm. When she drove to town for supplies, she bought a second-hand rifle. She keeps it loaded now, propped against the door jamb inside the cabin. The clerk at the hardware store showed her how to fire it, how to aim the sights. He winked and told her she could get a man with it at 20 yards. She said she didn't need a man, just wanted to do some hunting. She misses the dog. She carries the guns awkwardly over her shoulder when she goes to the woodpile or to the river. Her calendar hangs on the cabin wall, each day of summer marked with an X, the rest of the year clean and open. She turns up the wick of the lamp and starts to brush her hair, staring at her reflection in the window pane. She is thinking about leaving. She is thinking about driving out of the clearing. When the scream begins, it breaks against the walls. It shudders in a moan, then rises. Everything, even the wind, holds its breath. It is over so quickly that she almost believes it didn't happen, and raises the brush again, and barely recognizes herself in the glass. She runs to the lamp and blows out the flame, then to the window, hoping she will not see what must be there. She did not shoot cleanly the first time. When he ripped the screen and tore the siding loose, she stood on the porch, gun leveled. "Go away." He was no more than 10 feet from her when she fired. He spun around and fell to the ground, then raised himself up. When she realized that she had only wounded him, she ran into the cabin and turned the lock and leaned against the door. She could hear him thrashing and bellowing in the bushes and against the trees. She knew she would have to step onto the porch again, go to the ripped screen with nothing but night air between them. She would have to take aim and shoot again. And if that didn't stop him, she would have to slip the bolt and reload the rifle and stand there and shoot him again until he stopped bawling and weeping and falling down and getting up and lurching against the trees. When they began this, she never thought she would have to kill him so slow. She never dreamed she would have to hurt him so much. It's nearly dawn when he dies. When she gets up from her chair, when his groans stop pricking her skin. She takes the flashlight and goes out on the porch. She shines the beam around in the gray light and sees the blood dried on the new screen and on the fresh painted sill and spattered on the leaves around the cabin. She sees the trampled bushes and broken branches and where he crawled into the weeds. She shines the arc out, light bouncing on tree and log, until it lands on a black heap, huddled in the middle of the clearing. As soon as the sun rises, she begins to dig, and by mid-afternoon she is through with it. The rope tied to him, the car backed up to the hole, the rifle and the box of ammunition remembered and dropped in next to him, the musty soil put back, and branches over that. Then she bathes with the last of the water from the river and sweeps the cabin floor, thinking that the rain will wash away the blood, and that soon enough snow will fall and will cover it all. It's dark when she gets to the state line. Next summer, she will dig him up to take the claws. And that was Killing the Bear by Judith Minty. Now we will read N. Scott Momaday's She is Beautiful in Her Whole Being. A remarkable change came upon Gray almost at once. She stood and moved and talked differently. Here, in her mother's home, she assumed an attitude of deep propriety, dignity. With Set, she could still tease and joke and whisper words in her old diction, but now she spoke quietly, in a plain and simple way, and her language was that of rhythms and silences that he had not heard before. She put on the bright blouses and long pleated skirts of her mother's people. She combed out her long black hair and fashioned it in the old way, in a queue wrapped with white twine at the back of her head, and she adorned herself with silver and turquoise, old, simple pieces. She wore no makeup, except a pollen on her forehead and cheeks, which, after days, shone faintly, as from within, an orange-copper glow. Set observed her with wonder. She had been a beautiful girl. He held onto the vision of her in the buckskin dress, with feathers in her braided hair, her face painted, with a free and original and irrepressible spirit. And now, in a wholly different context, she was a beautiful woman, endowed with experience and purpose and grace. She ripened before his eyes. He felt almost boyish in her presence, and indeed, in keeping with the story, he must play out his part as Set Tali, Seu Tali, Boy Bear, Rock Tree Boy. But Gray had evolved from a girl into a woman, and he had been witness to it, and fittingly, he began to attend her. One day, while looking at her as she played with Daniba, it became clear to him that she belonged to him, and he to her. And he felt a happiness beyond anything he had ever known. That summer, they lived in the hogan beyond her mother's house. Little by little, Set fitted himself into the rhythm of life at Luka Chukai. In the night, he went out to see, as for the first time, the innumerable brilliant points of light in the sky. Looking at them, he thought he had never seen the night, and he wept and laughed and at last
kept the silence of the stars. In the early morning, he walked into the dawn's light, slowly at first, stiff with cold, but warming as the flood of light fell from the east, and he saw with wonder and fear and thanksgiving the land become radiant, defined by light and long, color-bearing distances. And when enough of his strength returned, he began to run. The boy ran. In the days, he drew and painted, watching the light change and the colors turn and shift upon the earth, the shadows extend and deepen. His paintings were strong and simple, primary, like those of a child. He listened to the wind and the birds and thunder rolling on the cliffs. In the darkness, there was the yip-yip-yipping of coyotes, and at first light, the coyotes set up a din that was otherworldly, that was like an electronic music descending from every point on the horizon to the center of creation, to this place, this Hogan. And he listened to the voices of Gray and her mother, of Antonia and Naniba, of old men and women passing by. He listened to the turning of their voices in the element of Dine Bizad, to the exotic words with their innumerable edges and hollows and inclines, Jits, Tlok, Tlitsi, Toril. And he began to understand and use very simple words and constructions in Navajo, A-O-O, Loda, Da-Tsi, Hagoni, Set-Yi-Nishe, Ash-Yi-Le. At first he did not know how to behave with Leela and Antonia, nor did they with him. But Gray was a good intermediary, and by and large all was well. Naniba made a great difference, too. She was, like Gray, mischievous and undaunted in her spirit. She took a liking to Set, and she taught him very quickly how to get along with her. He had no experience of children to speak of, and so he walked on eggs. Naniba adopted him. One day, when Gray was working at the loom, and Antonia had taken Naniba to Chinle to buy hay and grain, Leela approached close to Set. He was drawing. "She weaves well," Leela said, under an obligation to speak offhand. "I think so, too," Set said. "She talks like a Navajo." "I am glad," Set said. There was a long pause, which to Set was uncomfortable. To Leela, not. He made heavy strokes on the paper with a piece of charcoal. "She has told us that you are Kiowa," Set considered. Leela knew from the first that he was Kiowa. She, having been married to one, knew better than he what it was to be Kiowa. This oblique conversation would have frustrated him at one time. It did not frustrate him now. It was the proper way to proceed. "I am Kiowa," he said. "You have strong medicine," Leela said, as a matter of fact. "Yes. Gray knows of this medicine." "Not a question." "She gave it to me," he said. "Yes, so I have heard," Leela said. She was a large woman. She looked him in the eye for a long moment, wisps of hair turned on the air at her temples. Her hands were at her sides. He could read nothing in her eyes. After a long time, she said, "It is a hard thing to be what you must be, Da-Tsi." "Da-Tsi," he said. "Perhaps." There was another long pause. "Do you think you will marry my daughter?" Leela asked. She spoke in a considered way, with measured breath. Anachronism forwards, he thought. Her face was shining, especially her forehead and cheeks, and was almost the color of copper. Her face was wonderfully round. She held hands with herself. It was a habit with her. She held them clasped tightly together and low on her abdomen. Her hands were brown and shapely. On three of her fingers were silver rings with bright turquoise stones, she stood with her feet apart. Her stance and the lines of her body suggested a fine and firm balance. Puppies were romping and yelping in the shadow of the house. Butterflies were flitting and floating on the shine of the air. The walls of red rock in the distance appeared to vibrate in the rising heat. The spring had taken hold in the long valley. In looking out across the wide, warming land, Seth could conceive of the summer. It was a conception like memory, the remembered summertime of his boyhood at the Peter and Paul home, or at the house on Scott Street, and he marveled to feel his senses awakening, as Leela had conceived of it days and weeks ago. In advance of the final snowfall, when the skies above the Lukachukai Mountains were still curdled and dark, he drew his gaze back upon the closer ground to see Dog standing beyond the hogan, his ears pricked, appearing to search the horizon, standing like some old granitic cairn on the plain. And closer, before the hogan, Gray, at three quarters, sitting, her fine brown fingers picking at the loom. "I don't know," he said. He looked into her eyes and could see nothing devious there. Nothing, unless it was the faintest glint of mischief, a humor so tentative that he dare not count on it. "But it is a thing I have in mind." "You want to marry my daughter? See?" Then he heard himself say, "Yes, yes, I do. I want to marry your daughter. There is nothing I want more than that." Then he thought of her asking, "You have told her this?" And he was ashamed. He searched desperately for some plausible answer. "No, not yet. I did not know. I have not been clear in my mind. I'm going to tell her now." But it did not come to that. Instead, Leela said, "My daughter is a beautiful woman, like me." "Yes, she is. She is beautiful in her whole being, like me." "Yes. She will bear beautiful children, like me." "Yes." "But you, if I may speak in a clear way, you are sick. This I have heard. This I have seen. The bear stands against you." "Yes." "Yes?" "Yes, I am sick. I have been sick for a long time, but I hope to be well and strong. I can be well and strong with Gray's help. She knows how to help me. I've become stronger since I have been here, because of Gray."
Yes?
I have been afflicted. The bear stands against me." I am the bear." In the early mornings, when he inhaled the cold air that ran down from the mountains, and when he touched the earth through the soles of the moccasins Leela and Gray had made for him, he knew how glad he was to be alive. His skin grew darker, and his body began to grow hard, and his hair grew over his ears and shaggy at the nape of his neck. It seemed to him that he could see a little farther into the distance each day, and that his legs were hardening and becoming more flexible at the ankles and knees, his stride longer and more regular and persistent. He ran until the sweat streamed on his body, and he tasted the salty exertion at the corners of his mouth, and he ran on until his breathing came in time with his stride, and his whole body was fitted into the most delicate and precise rhythm. He entered into the current of the wind, of water running, of shadows extending, of sounds rising up and falling away. His life was in motion. In motion was his life. He ran until running became the best expression of his spirit, until it seemed he could not stop, that if he stopped, he would lose his place in the design of creation, and beyond that, until his lungs burned and his breath came hard and fast and loud, and his legs and feet were almost too heavy to lift, and beyond that, deeper into the rhythm, into a state of motion, mindless and inexorable, without end. And when he returned to the hogan, Gray bathed him while he stood naked, allowing his body to settle down. Then she gave him water to drink, and a kind of gruel made of crushed corn and goat's milk, pinion and dried fruit. And in the manner of old Navajo men 100 years ago, he wrapped his loins in white cloth and lay down on a pallet in the shade of a juniper near the loom, and Gray slowly kneaded the muscles in his shoulders and back and legs. She made a mild abrasive out of sand and oil and massaged his feet, and she sat beside him, singing softly, stirring the air over him with a grass broom, and he sank into deep relaxation. And in the afternoon, he drew and painted and dreamed and set his mind upon marriage. He spoke Navajo to Layla as far as he could, and he was not offended when she laughed at him. He played games with Naniba and put notions of the wide world in her head. He instructed her in painting, and in turn she gave him words, the words of a child, which are at the center of language. And he observed with deep appreciation, wonder, and respect Gray's return to the Navajo world. In the late afternoon, they convened at Layla's table. There was usually lamb or mutton, and dried corn and tinned tomatoes, and beans and dried fruit. There were wonderful breads, fried bread, cornbread, oven bread. Set liked best the dense, sweet oven bread, baked in the horno of adobe bricks and mud plaster. It was the bread of the Pueblos. Layla had learned to make it when she was a girl attending the fiestas in the ancient towns on the Rio Grande. At dusk, Gray prepared a sweat lodge for him, a small conical hogan with an opening on the west. When the stones in the pit were hot and the flames had died down, Gray and Set entered the sweat lodge in breech cloths and sat next to each other. Gray poured water on the stones, and they hissed and let off steam. In the bare light of the embers, before they were extinguished, Set looked at Gray discreetly, saw her smooth skin shining and glistening, as bright beads of water appeared on her forehead, her throat, her shoulders, and her thighs. The tips of her breasts were nearly as dark as her hair. He watched as she leaned to pour the water, her long side and flank shining, her toes flexing into the sand. Discreetly he watched, the heat of the steam and of his desire coming upon him. And for a time he became dull and heavy, as on the verge of sleep, dreaming of the woman beside him, dreaming longingly of her body, which was so anomalously soft and firm, which was so exciting in its curves and lines and hollows and folds, of the smell of her when she came fresh from sleep, of her casual gestures, of her voice in the day and night, when she spoke of this and that with interest or excitement, or with anger or frustration or sorrow, of the breathy cooing of her ecstasy, of her singing softly, of her gently breathing in the night. And then the drowsiness and dreaming dissolved, and he felt suddenly refreshed and invigorated and clean and hot. And he began to laugh, and Gray too, and they touched, and their hands slipped over their bodies, describing desire, but yet discreetly, for Layla and perhaps Antonia and Naniba might be close by. All things in their places. In this little house was peace and purification. Outside, the evening air bit them with cold and was sharply delicious. And they walked away from the house and hogan and lay down on a dune, observing the night sky. And later, when the moon was high, they rode horses into the arroyos among shadows that were like pools of time and eternity. At the end of April, a man came down from the Chuscas, bringing mountain earth. In the center of the hogan, he constructed an altar and performed a ceremony through most of the night. Set and Gray sat side by side to the left of the priest. Coals were laid upon the altar, and a fire stick was placed in the coals just so on the east side, so that the pointed end smoldered and shone like a firebrand. Crystals were placed here and there on the altar's rim. The priest arranged his paraphernalia before him. There were herbs and pollens, a gourd rattle, pots of liquors and teas, peyote pastes, leather fans, a bowl of water, and an eagle bone whistle. Naniba slept on a pallet at the wall of the hogan. Leela and Antonia assisted the priest, keeping the coals alive, sprinkling sage and cedar, crushed with tobacco in their fingers, bringing water and coals as needed. Set and Gray glanced at each other occasionally, and sometimes they touched hands, but they were concentrated upon the ceremony. Smoke was fanned upon them, and when it was proper to do so, they spoke of their visions. Their visions were very beautiful, and their words were the best that there were in their hearts, and their voices were joined in the smoke to other voices, ancient and original. Their voices were soft and everlasting, and in them were laughter and wailing and reverence and awe. And they made stories and songs and prayers. And in the dark early morning, after they had gone out of the hogan to say themselves to the night sky and returned, they stood before the altar, holding each other close. In their honor, the priest gave the fire stick to the fire, and they knew, though it was not an explicit knowledge, that they were married. In ceremony, in tradition out of time, in a sacred manner, in beauty, they were married forever. And that was She's Beautiful in Her Whole Being. And that was by N. Scott Momaday. And we'll conclude with a very short story by Mickey Roberts called The Indian Basket. The year was 1988, a bitterly cold morning in an early winter. I held the small Indian basket, beautiful and artistic in the distinctive Native American tradition. It was clearly no copy of an Indian basket. It was the real thing, and I did not have to be told that it was authentic. The basket was laid out on a table at a garage sale, and the ticket said it was for sale for $250. I inquired of the owner as to who had made the basket, and it was told it was made by the Thompson River Tribe. The owner went on to say that the basket was well worth the money, for the Indians no longer made these works of art. I did not satisfy an urge to ask if tribes made baskets, for, being fair to the man, he could not have known the name of the Indian artist when it had never been asked for in the first place. As I stood holding the basket, I remembered a bitterly cold day in the year 1939. It was the beginning of the winter season. We walked the streets of Bellingham, my mother, my great-grandmother, and me. We were selling Indian baskets. I was a very small girl, and I kept saying I wanted to go home. But my mother kept saying, "Just one more house." We all carried baskets, large ones, small ones, round ones, even square ones. Some were rectangular with perfectly fitted covers, which were designed to be used as picnic baskets. How many hours of hard labor these baskets represented for my grandmother, who could speak only in her native tongue. My grandmother had worked hard all her life, and she had raised many children, and had also raised my mother, who was her granddaughter. Somehow, she had survived the changes that life had forced upon her with the changing life in a different culture. At each house, my mother would ask the occupant to look at the Indian baskets and suggest a price of a few articles of used clothing. If the woman of the house decided to look at the baskets and bring out some clothing she didn't want, the bargaining would begin. As in the case of our tribe's treaty, two generations earlier, the main decision would be at the discretion of the newcomer, and many hours of labor would go for a few shirts or dresses. These days, the price of Indian baskets is very high, and they are mostly owned by non-Indians. These treasures, obtained at less than bargain basement prices, are now being sold at premium prices, if they are obtainable at all. They are collector's items, but the name of the person who labored to make them is rarely known. As we peddled our treasures in those early years, we probably appeared to be a pitiful people. We were, however, living in as dignified a manner as possible while selling a part of our culture for a few articles of used clothing. We really hadn't much left to give. And that was Mickey Roberts' story, The Indian Basket. Thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove. Aye, yippee-i-ho.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device as well.